Hope that drove me down to Richmond and got me back home. And it is hope that's going to keep me moving on through this year, 2022. Because at the end of the day, no matter what you have in hand, if you have hope, you kind of have everything. Which leads us to our next speaker. Diane Flint led the keynote address on the opening day of CiderCon 2022, and I'm going to be reading her bio that was on the CiderAssociation.org website. It reads, Diane began in 1997 when she founded Foggy Ridge Cider, the first licensed cidery in the South, by planting cider apples, including many southern varieties. From 2004 to 2018, Foggy Ridge Cider produced 5,300 gallons a year of orchard-focused ciders that were distributed across 15 states. Since its first production, Foggy Ridge Cider gained a national reputation for high-quality cider. Foggy Ridge was featured on CBS Sunday Morning Show and in publications including Gourmet, Imbibe, Savior, Garden & Gun, Esquire, and Martha Stewart Living. Food & Wine magazine named Foggy Ridge a small batch superstar in 2010. Made in America awarded Foggy Ridge a 2012 American Treasures Award recognition for artisan producers. Foggy Ridge Cider received many Best of Awards, including a top rating from the New York Times for its Serious Cider Blend. Diane Flint herself was nominated for the James Beard Award for Outstanding Beverage Professionals in 2015 and 2016, and was a finalist for this award in 2017 and 2018. She speaks on cider, farming, and food culture in national and regional forums. And so it is with that that I ask all of you out there in Ciderville to raise a glass and join this presentation with Diane Flint of Foggy Ridge Cider, based in Virginia.
I'm just honored to be here and honored to have the gift of your time and attention. As growers and makers, we all want our work to have meaning, and it means so much to be listened to. So thank you for that gift. And I hope that I have a few words for you today that will help our collective voices be heard. Before I get started on my short talk here, I want to recognize a really important person in the room you all should know, and that's Jocelyn Kozalka. Jocelyn was the cider maker at Foggy Ridge for our most formative years. She's a talented beverage professional, a dear friend, wonderful colleague. I know some of you will be attending her presentation and workshop, but get to know her. She is such a resource. I also, Virginia Cider has gotten a big old hurrah up here from several speakers. Thank you all for recognizing what the state has done. I particularly want to call out several cideries that were instrumental in the forming the foundation of cider in the state. They were real pioneers, and I feel like compatriots with me, and that would be Bold Rock and my dear friends at Albemarle Cider Works and at Blue Bee. Feel like the work that you see in Virginia Cider is on the shoulders of those cideries. They are the pioneers. Eleanor and I were just talking about this. I remember my first CiderCon meeting. I think we figured out it was in 2012, maybe. We were in a tiny little hotel room in Portland. There were less than 50 of us, and it was just incredible. I got to meet people I had only talked to on the phone. I felt like, you know, I had colleagues at last. It was incredible. I learned so much about science and agriculture, what I consider the twin pillars of cider making. But most of all, when I got on that plane in Portland and flew back across the country, I felt like I had this wind of inspiration behind me. And I think that's the best of what events like this can give you. So I encourage you to take advantage of learning from your colleagues, the people at your table, as I did so many years ago. Learn from the experts, the researchers, the specialists, the experienced cider makers. Learn from them. But most of all, take away inspiration. And when you leave Richmond at the end of this great conference, go back to your work inspired to do better work and to make better cider. That's the gift of events like this. So as you can tell by my accent, we are in the South. But if you look at this map, we are only at the tip of the South. There is a lot more south of this South. In this room are cider makers from Georgia and North Carolina, from Kentucky and Tennessee. They're apple growers from states that you thought didn't know anything about cider and apples, like Alabama and South Carolina. Learn from them and learn about the exciting things going on throughout the South. And I'm going to talk about the whole region, and I hope paint a picture. My goal is to paint a picture of the rich cider and apple tradition that all of these Southern cider makers are building upon. It's a tradition that's rich with history, a complex history that has already been alluded to, but also a region that is rich with possibility for the future. And I hope by the end of my few words here, you will be inspired to look to my region for resources that you can take back to your home territory. But I also hope to inspire you to look at your own backyard with a new set of eyes. I asked Eleanor a couple of weeks ago what I should focus on in this talk, and she said, you should talk about the importance of storytelling. And I have to say I winced, because to me storytelling it's sort of like artisan or sustainable. It's lost its currency. And when I hear the word storytelling, I automatically think somebody is going to try to sell me something that I don't want. But the more I thought about what Eleanor told me, the more I believe that we should reclaim at least the meaning of storytelling. It is... And I'm going to start my talk today with history, because the stories are what make up history. So if you Google the first orchard in America, or you read any article written on cider in October, it will say that the first orchard in America was in Massachusetts, right? Well, 11 years before that orchard, and 56 miles east of here in Jamestown, Thomas Gates planted a seedling orchard of apple and pear trees. The first orchard in the South, right? Well, many scholars believe that apples could have made it to the South up from Nova Scotia and Maine in the 1500s and traveled down indigenous trade routes down the spine of the Appalachians, from the northern Appalachians, where my dear friend Autumn Stoschek makes cider, to the southern Appalachians, where I do. Another group of scholars believes that apples could have come from the South, from the Portuguese and Spanish in Florida, who brought citrus and peaches that quickly covered the South. After all, there is an apple that originated in the Florida Panhandle, and there are 8 that originated in Louisiana. Apples pop up all over the South when white farmers pushed into Native American territory in Alabama, and they came upon the old fort at Mobile, the old French fort. It was surrounded by an apple orchard. At the time of the Indian Removal Act in 1830, the largest indigenous population in the East was in Georgia. And when the Cherokee and Creeks were forcibly removed from land they had occupied for thousands of years, they left behind apple orchards, hundreds and hundreds of apple orchards. They were gifted horticulturalists. They cultivated apples. These were fenced orchards and selected varieties. And after they were evicted from their land and their farm, a Georgia nurseryman named Jarvis Van Buren went up into Cherokee land over several seasons and gathered scion wood from those orchards and introduced those apples into the nursery trade. I read a quote recently that the southern orchard is grafted on the trunk of a Cherokee apple tree, and there's a lot of truth in that. So back to Virginia. By 1622, we were planting grafted trees. We were getting scion wood from England and grafting trees here. So it wasn't just seedling orchards. And we had huge orchards. In Virginia's northern neck, a man named William Fitzhugh planted thousands of trees. And it's perhaps the most written about early Southern orchard. It was almost 3,000 apple trees in sandy soil in a region of 10 feet elevation. And of course, when we say William Fitzhugh planted apple trees in the South, we say that in the same sense that we do when we say Thomas Jefferson made cider. It was the enslaved men and women who planted those thousands of trees among the stumps of virgin forest and fenced it with a locust fence. By the 1700s, seedling orchards covered the South. The South remained rural longer. We kept seedling orchards longer. Those seedling orchards grew in soil from sandy soil to Piedmont clay to mountain loam in a wide, wide range of climates. That genetic diversity just spurted out there. And the Southern seedling apple orchard is so diverse. And from that, like farmers everywhere, Southerners, Black, white, and Indigenous, selected apple varieties from among those seedling trees that suited their uses and needs, that gave them the flavor that they wanted. And of course, those uses include cider. I think the book title, which should come up next, yes, there it is. I think this title says it all. In the South, we didn't have towns like you had in the North. There weren't these communal apple presses that everybody took their apples to. We had to do it ourselves. Every home was a distillery and a cidery. And as Darlene Hayes wrote about recently in an article all of you should read, the work of cider making and distilling often fell to women and often fell to enslaved women. You know that when I talk about cider apples, the Southern cider apples, the first words out of my mouth will be Hughes crabapple. I mean, it's an apple I planted back in 1997, which might have been the first commercial planting. And according to Dr. David Zakalik at Cornell, who did a recent survey on what cider-specific apples you use to make cider, Hughes crabapple is the only American variety on that list. That's just criminal. My mission today is to change that. There's so many other fruit, there's so many other apples that confer complex flavor, and many of them come from the South, and those are widely adapted and enduring fruit. I do love Hughes crabapple, though. It's one of my favorite cider apples. But it's not all the South has to offer when it comes to cider apples. I want you to take a look at this list of superb cider apples. This is a list of just pulled from nursery catalogs. Over 150 years, these apples were sold in the South as cider apples. And I grow four or five of them. I love Parmar. I wish I had more of it. It's intensely flavored, just intensely sweet and very, very acidic. I'm planting at my advanced age. I am planting trees. I just want you to know, you have no excuse. I'm planting winter John. I have a row, and then this spring, Raul and Mary Godinez are going to help me top work some trees over to winter John, a really exciting cider apple I want to experiment with. And if you come to the cider, if you're lucky enough to come to the Southern Cider panel tomorrow, you'll hear about Southern cider makers who make cider with Keener Seedling, Kiner's Choice, Red and Black Limber Twig, and Madame Mesquite. Madame Mesquite is a really, to me, exciting apple from the coastal North Carolina. And Southern cider makers today believe that these apples actually confer many of the flavor attributes of the English bittersweets. So worth looking into. So how did all these trees get out in the world? Before the 20th century, the South had fabulous nurseries, and they were in the most unexpected places, places you would never think of as having anything to do with apples. Pomaria, South Carolina, outside of Columbia, Washington, Mississippi, Augusta, Georgia, Clarksville, Georgia, I told you apples grew all over the South. I wanted to take a look. Pomaria is a nursery that especially interested me as I was researching my book. They grew a lot of hyper-local apples, apples from William Summers' neighbors in South Carolina. This list of apples from Pomaria, these are some of these are from Edisto Island, which is off the coast of Charleston. Cook's Red Winter was said to be superior to Red Limber Twig. They said that Hammond had better flavor than Newtown Pippin. These are well adapted apples to coastal and central South Carolina. In Augusta, Georgia, a Belgian immigrant with a triple barrel name, Jules Prosper Alphonse Berkmans, operated what is probably the best-known nursery in the South called Fruitlands. His nursery and Pomaria both listed at one time over 400 apple varieties on their lists. And Fruitlands persisted into the 20th century, and it exists today. Berkman's home is the clubhouse of the Augusta National Golf Course, and the golf course is on the grounds of the old nursery. That home was built with enslaved labor before Berkmans moved into it. When you think of the South, you don't think of the Deep South as having apples. Here's a list of apples from Southern nurseries in Mississippi, grown in Alabama, Mississippi, South Georgia. Shell of Alabama is one apple that has very low chill days and is grown now in Africa. So, we also have in the South a great wild apple diversity. Many of you are familiar with Gary Nabhan's work. He's an ethnobotanist and MacArthur Grant winner. He has written that the Southern Appalachians have the greatest remaining apple diversity in America. So let me just sum it up. We've got a lot of wild apples today. We had seedling orchards all over the South for hundreds of years. We have close to 2,000 apples that originated in the South and are widely adapted to hot, humid growing conditions. These apples deserve another look. They deserve your hard look, and I encourage you to learn about them and plant them. Okay, so how are you going to do that? You've got a lot of people in the room to talk to about that. I would point out a few here. Jeff Wheeler, I believe, is here from the University of Kentucky. He's doing some research on cider apples. Josh Feuder is sitting right over there. He is one of the originators of the Georgia Heritage Apple Orchard, planted over 130 apples long grown in Georgia and originating in Georgia. Horn Creek Farm is the repository of Lee Calhoun's collection of over 400 Southern apple varieties in Pinnacle, North Carolina. Here today, you've got Virginia Tech resources, you've got that Southern cider panel tomorrow, and you have apple growers and cider makers all over the South, some of whom use these apples. So, I asked Michelle what I should talk about, and she said I should talk a little bit about the Foggy Ridge story, and I have just a few words on that because I think it connects to Southern fruit. It also connects to this industry which I care so much about. Foggy Ridge cider was always all about the flavor of fruit from a place, and my business model, such as it was, reflected the inclinations of the founder, of me. Foggy Ridge, as you can see from the map, is way over in Southwest Virginia, 5 hours from Richmond. Yes, Virginia is a large state. And I was never interested in running a restaurant. I didn't want to host weddings, didn't want to get big, didn't want to spend all my day on a computer. Really didn't particularly want bands and food trucks on my farm every weekend. I wanted to grow exceptional cider fruit, and I wanted me and my team to make the very best cider we could from that fruit. I wanted to express a place through fruit. I also wanted the best sommeliers in the country to write about my cider. I wanted them to put it in their restaurants and shops. I wanted the wine writers to think about cider. I wanted Foggy Ridge and cider to be at the table of American beverages, to be thought about, to be talked about, to have meaning and to be listened to. The way I attempted to do that was simply to tell my story again and again and again and again, an authentic story about place and fruit. I bet not many of you have attended a Southern Baptist church service. If you have, you know there's something at the end of the service called an altar call. That's where you come down to the front and you profess your faith. I am not going to ask you to come down to the front because of COVID, but I am going to ask you in the next few minutes before I wrap up to think about what you put faith in. I talked to Greg Pak a couple of weeks ago, and he reminded me that 10 years ago when he was applying for cider grants, people were saying, oh, I don't know if I should give you money. You know, this cider thing, it's going to be like a 10-year wine cooler. I don't know if it's worth it. He said, now he doesn't have any trouble. He doesn't get that anymore. He doesn't hear about cider being a flash in the pan. We have successful national brands to be proud of. We have solid, good quality regional cider brands to be proud of. We have many people making cider that is on cider that's on the radar of national publications. But I still think we are only teetering on the edge of success. Not enough people drink cider. Not enough people are willing to pay for cider that's made with the fruit that will confer the most complex flavor. Not enough people are willing to pay for cider in a way that orchardists can make a living growing fruit for that cider, or get excited about planting a whole lot more of that fruit. The American Cider Association has had courageous conversations around race and gender and privilege and the history of our beverage. I think we can do the same around fruit and around what we need to do and do better to have a bigger seat and a louder voice. When I started Foggy Ridge, I wanted cider to be listened to. I wanted it to be a meaningful part of the beverage discussion because I think we have a lot to offer. We are a big tent organization, and that's a good thing. But to have that meaningful multi-generation seat at the table, more of you need to focus your story on fruit. More of you need to either grow apples or work closely with the orchardist in the room and in your regions to plant the kind of apples that will cause discussion, that will confer great flavor, and that will be part of your story. As Eleanor recently said in her letter to you, she said, our future as an industry is strengthened when we link cider with apples. And I totally agree with her. Our ingredient grows on trees. If we try to compete on price with beverages that are made with row crops and water, we are not doing ourselves a good service. We need authentic stories from all of you, and you have them. I know many of you, and you have those stories. I encourage you to talk about them, to link them to your beverage, and to really focus on fruit. I think that's our path forward. When I started Foggy Ridge Cider back in 1997, I wanted cider's voice in the room. I believe we have a great deal to add, and I believe it's a complex add. Let's don't flatten that story. Let's make it rich and deep and complex. I hope my tales about nurseries and apples and regions and soils and people and cider in the South inspires you to uncover those same stories in your regions. Those are meaningful things to talk about. So I gave you a history lesson because it's the story in history that gives us power. I look forward to hearing your conversations in the future. You've got two great days ahead of you. Go out there and learn something to make you better. Thank you.
Take away inspiration. That is what Diane Flint is all about. She's really inspiring, isn't she? And early on, she mentioned a woman by the name of Eleanor while she was speaking. Well, that was actually Eleanor Leger, who just was reelected as the president for the American Cider Association, and she founded Eden Specialty Ciders in Vermont. We love Eleanor. She's awesome, a great supporter of Cider Chat. And also Michelle, and that is